Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listed on the menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to continue along, recounting our conversations with the fabulous talent in Melbourne at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival and the world's 50 best restaurants.
And one of them invited the other. So we invited some of the top contenders in the 50 best restaurant awards. To do the master classes, which are a traditional part of the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, but this year really had an absolutely all-star lineup. First up, ladies first, of course, Elena Arzak from her family's restaurant in San Sebastian in Spain. Then Dan Barber from New York City and Stone Barns up in the Hudson Valley. Blue Hill at Stone Barns, right? Blue Hill.
And Virgilio Martinez from a number of restaurants, but Central is his flagship restaurant in Lima, Peru.
And finally, the latest and greatest idea in French cuisine, according to Yannick Aleno, all about how to reduce sauces properly for maximum effect.
And flavor.
So you'll want to hang on for those at the end of the program. Don't tune out early because he's well worth the price of admission. Anyway, first up, our old friend Elena Arzak, always thoughtful.
Okay, ask me whatever you want.
Elena, first of all, why don't you just explain your restaurant, the situation in your restaurant, how long it's been going on, how your father started it, and so forth. Just a little background.
See, I will tell you. The restaurant has been always in the same building. I'm the fourth generation. My grandmother was a chef. I still with my father. He's 74. He's still involved because my father is, you know, very powerful. He's like Mick Jagger. No, you cannot imagine. He's a passionate. He already phoned me 5 times. No. My grandparents were chefs also, no? My grandmother, she was a widow, very young. And she was a very good chef, so my grandmother, she cooked very well, and then she lived with us at home. So I grew up in a family where the most important is the food. So until I was 10 years old, I thought everybody was a chef. You understand? Because at home we talk about food, about all the time, no? And I lived the period that was, my father was very young, of the movement of the new Basque cuisine, no? It was incredible at that time. For example, my father brought a chapter in a book for Paul Bocuse, no? It was incredible, the effort they did. And so I grew up with this atmosphere. I saw how Arzak changed without having Michelin stars 2, 1, 2, and 3, no? And for me, I like it very much. During the summer holidays, I used to go to see my grandmother, my mother, my father, with my sister, 2 hours per day, only in July and August, no? And when you finish school with 18, I was not forced. My sister is a historian of art. She works in the Guggenheim Museum. And what I did is I decide I want to do gastronomy. In the very first beginning, my parents said, come on, Elena. One thing is, like, you come here 2 hours per day having a lot of fun. And another thing is being, I saw, don't worry, I saw that. No, perhaps you will think I could have an easier life, but I wanted this life. No? I went to Switzerland to hotel and cooking school in Lucerne. I could speak German. And then I made a lot of training in France, in Britain, and in Italy. I spent 7 years abroad, and I go back to Arzak. In Arzak, of course, my father was very happy. I was there, and he told me, you know, Elena, I want you to do so much as possible. No? The first plate I did with him together, I was 19. I'm 47. So imagine. And still we work the same, no? And it was very interesting. I could stay abroad, not be in Arzak, but I felt very realized. And I said, I can do a lot in my family restaurant. No, to maintain the level was for me a challenge, no? And I saw I could do a lot of creativity and changes. And they were always very open, my parents. They risk sometimes a lot, you know. And especially, imagine I was entering into a system where worked very well. And I said, oh, now I want to do changes that perhaps this will make change the system. But my father said, Elena, we need to risk. No, and I'm the same mentality now. No, I do things that sometimes we are not sure they are going to work. But if you don't risk, you will never go further.
What's it like being a woman?
See, well, in all this STEM, as I told you, I'm from San Sebastian. San Sebastian is a matriarchal. The Basque society is a matriarchal, where the woman is always very strong. So, especially in the restaurants in San Sebastian, there are many restaurants where a woman in the kitchen. So, because the Artag in the 70s was a normal restaurant, a popular restaurant, no famous in the beginning. So, and I have many friends that works in restaurants in the family business. So being a woman for us is normal. In Artag, 80% of the staff, we are women. Eh? In the kitchen, 7 women, chef de partie. So my father never made a difference between man and woman because he worked with a grandmother. Uh-huh. And when he was a child, he was the only man in the restaurant. So, you know, I grew up without thinking that there is a difference, no? People... I know it's not all over the world like that. I'm talking about San Sebastian. So for me, now I realize, not now, but in the last time, that if you take a list or you take guides, there are very few women.
Why do you think that?
Sorry, I will tell you. When my father studied gastronomy in Madrid, when he was young, there was 3 women and a lot of men. When I studied in Switzerland, it was equal. Now in the Basque Culinary Center, for example, is the University of Food, is equal. You understand? Here in Holmsgren, it's a school of here. I met them last time. It's a lot of women also. You know why? Because it's, for me, it's a social question. Before, 30 or 40 years ago, the woman was restricted the job at home, and now he's socializing. He's coming out from. I think needs time. Needs time.
Do you think it's harder for women?
Well, not in my case, because you know I grew up like that.
But outside of Basque society.
Yeah. Well, in our case, the strength and the atmosphere is so equal that the only I had to concentrate is to work too much, to work very much and to form and to achieve your work. I will tell you an example. I have 2 children. One is 12 years old, the other is 10. And the year was born, my oldest child, we have born 5 more children in Artag. And we are still open. You understand? So it's possible. You understand? It's true that if you talk to another woman, perhaps if she's in a space where it's not the same conditions, I hope my example could help them to this normality. You understand?
Here's a funny one for you. When we dined at Arzak a number of years ago, we noticed one thing that was actually 2 things that were interesting. First of all the servers were women. There was only 1 man in the dining room who was a sommelier, and he didn't look very happy.
No, of course we accept men in Arzak. Don't think so. But you know this, as I told you, we always have been like that, no? I really, even if I worked in France or I was sometimes the only woman in the team. But the predisposition of the people today, they want to have more women. I think it's a question of time. It's my opinion. There will be more, no? But of course, is you to have a super organization. I have, and all the women in Artag, we have a super organization when you have children, for example, no? Sí. No, but
that's amazing.
Don't think we don't accept men in the restaurant.
Talk a little bit about Igor and the flavor lab, which I understand is so much larger now than it was when I saw it. And experimenting, you take risk. What are you risking now?
See, what we do in Artsakh, what we do is, you know, when you travel, you got a lot of spices of someone. What happened? We had spices all over, in the car, at home, in the office, no? And my father, in the year 2000, talked with Ferran Adrià from El Bulli, and they said, you know, we need to organize all that. The first that had a lab was Ferran Adrià, and a few years later, we. So we separate the production from the thinking, no? But everything we do is very practical. So it's not because it's like we want to show we have a lab. No, we use. There are two chefs that work with my father and me, because sometimes you have lot of ideas, but you don't have time to achieve them. You can now. I can go into the Guinness book how many things I burned. No, you are doing a testing. Elena, telefono. You are right. You are completely burnt, no? The chefs many years ago made a lot of jokes about me, and Elena is very dangerous. You are very dangerous, no? So, no, I apart of that. What we separate with Halab is a space where two chefs that help us to develop the ideas that work long time with us. They are very kind, and they are very open. They don't mind if, for example, I tell them, please, I want to do an ice cream of avocado. They gave us five different versions. We didn't like them. Please, could you do another one? Put perhaps more lemon or put a little bit of milk. So they repeat. No, and we are open to their ideas. No, and so in this lab, we have a lot of machines. Lot of machines is the high technology, freeze-dry machine, we have distillation, we have a special cutting machines. For example, we have now extracto, que saca extractos de hierbas. Jugos de extractos de hierbas. No, no de still. Es como una centrifugadora, como una
centrifuge.
Sí, is, but not exactly a centrifuge. It's like a manual machine. It's very interesting, no? You get the essence of the herbs, no? In a very natural way, in very like juices, no? So we do lot of things, but everything we have in this lab needs to help the product, you understand, to make it better. It's not because of sophistication to say we use that or we use that, because everything we do needs to help the plate. Also, today the chefs, we are multidisciplinary. We look on other fields, and because they are not our fields, I'm not an historian, I'm not a physic, I'm not a psychologist. No, I'm not a painter. We need to ask them. I did a study of how the color influences the food, for example, no? And the color of the food, no? Me, as a Basque, I use a lot of green because I like. You understand? It's fresh. No, I like bright colors always. And I use a lot of color in my food, no? For the presentation. I'm very order. And I do lots of square things. My father is not so order, and he likes round. You understand? what we do is we ask help to research centers, to people that are not on our field, no? And this is why the food stem is endless. There are so many things to do, no? Me, for example, I like everything I do. I see so much information, not only for us, for you also, around the world. No, you see 3D, you see technology, you see advertising. No, when you see advertising in a magazine, some of them are very nice, no? No, and everything helps you. No, I can see this vase of flowers. I see. I could do a garnish like that with vegetables, like a bunch, and serve it here. You understand? So we always look in what we see, no? More or less, but I mean, technology is important to evolve, but it's not the focus. If you use very nice technology, but doesn't match the product, don't use it. Our creativity is more around the plate. No? We try to be local. I mean, if I were born in New York, my food would be different. No? But I was born in San Sebastian and my family is Basque. So, of course, my style and my father's style is very local for the raw products. You understand? Mm-hmm. No, but I think I don't want to say that I find if I go to New York that they don't do the food of New York. It depends where you are born, no? I think I like also the variety. I don't like we cook everybody the same. It's too boring. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I don't want to be in Melbourne and eating the same as in Madrid, no? So I know I hear the presentations are very natural. You understand? I like that.
So what is that?
Sorry, just one last question.
What is the identity of the Basque cuisine?
The identity of the Basque cuisine. So is we like, for example, very much garlic. We like parsley. The fish for us is very important. We like very fresh fish and very seasonal fish. Mm-hmm. And every fish we cook in a different way. This has learned us the story. We like, from one side, strong flavors. We like, for example, peppers. But there's other flavors. We don't know why. It's not an explanation. For example, coriander, we like mixed with parsley. No? Coconut mixed with milk is a food very subtle, but we like spices, for example. Mm-hmm. It's subtle for the product. The product, we don't cover it very much. No? You understand what I mean? The cooking methods are very subtle, no? Because the product is so good that we don't need to do very much to it. You understand what I mean? Mm-hmm.
So that you don't boil the ingredients much?
No.
Sorry, just another question. Just a clarification of what you said earlier. Here the food is naturally given here in Australia.
Okay. I like because they use the natural to present. Lot of
in Australia.
See, the presentation of the plates, they use lot of leaves, they use lot of local ingredients, but for the presentation, no? I like that, no? Because reminds you that the nature is our future. No? Without the nature, we will never got products. You understand?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Muy bien. Thank you. Gracias.
And we'll be back with Dan Barber right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Dan Barber from Blue Hill at Stone Barns up in the Hudson Valley and Blue Hill in New York City. I think astounded everybody, certainly surprised everybody, coming in with the highest number of points climbed in the world's 50 best. But when you hear what he has to say, you'll understand why it is that his presence in the food community is valued so much.
He actually is. He is highly intellectual and has, if you hadn't read his latest book, which is a couple years now, it is the latest absolutely essential addition to the culinary canon called the third plate. And it gives you an idea of all that goes into what he does.
I'm such a big part of the conversation in the world of food, but you're one of the pioneers. What do you think's made it so popular?
So I love being called a pioneer, so I won't disabuse you of that idea, but I don't know that foraging would be the way to describe what I've done, because I actually know so little about foraging. I'm much more interested in sculpting a landscape through agriculture. Whereas foraging, at least in the definition that I'm hearing from you, is about going out into the wild and being responsive to what the land is just giving you through nature, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah. Sorry, except, let me rephrase that providence, let's say.
Sorry?
Let me rephrase that to providence.
Providence, okay, then yes. Then I'm interested in what is possible through the manipulation of a landscape. We often talk about manipulating landscape in very negative, pejorative terms. And I actually, through my research for this book that I wrote called The Third Plate, over the last 10 years I researched, what I came away with, if there's one theme, I don't know if there's only one, but the one theme that struck me is that throughout history, one of the great lessons of cuisines is the manipulation of local environments to actually improve environments. We don't often talk about farming and agriculture through improvement. We talk about less damage. But actually, from the beginning of time, the lesson of peasant interactions with the landscape was a constant undertaking of improvement. And to me, it's very, very important for today's conversation as we look at a world that's environmentally very challenged, ecologically very challenged, as we continue to feed a growing population and try and do it democratically and nutritiously. It's not that agriculture is an enemy, it's that agriculture and the food culture for which demands that agriculture needs to be more responsive to what the ecological conditions are of the place. And to do that, we need to think differently about how we sculpt a landscape. I believe you can sculpt a landscape and over time improve the soil conditions, the flora and the fauna, and have the most delicious cuisine and diet. I say that with such authority because that's the history of everyone's culture for the longest time. Peasants were always eking out what the land could provide and then making it tasty and delicious for their family and their community. The answer to your question is thank you for the compliment, but I'm really looking and being inspired by what happened over the history of time with all the great cuisines of the world. My problem is that I feel handicapped because the United States, as everyone knows, it doesn't have a food culture. It doesn't have that history. So when Massimo Bottura or René Redzepi, for that matter, tethers himself to the past, and in Massimo, he's tethering himself to a lot with Italian cuisine, with René, he's tailoring himself to Viking cuisine. I don't actually know what that is, but there's something there for which they are then taking that and exploding, modernizing it, and looking around to the ecological conditions that surround them and creating in a pattern of eating that supports that. I believe this is very important, and it's what I would like to do for the future of my restaurant. But I have to sort of create it out of whole cloth because there is no history. We were always such a rich country, rich agriculture. We're young. You throw a seed into the ground, you're the Garden of Eden. But that's in part because our soil is so great and we had temperate climates and whatever. And we never were forced into the kind of creative ideas that peasants were forced into to create the greatest cuisines of the world. So anyway, this is the lesson for me, from my book.
Talk about your pop-up that you... It's a waste.
Yeah. So I did a pop-up in London the last 5 weeks with a menu that was devoted to food waste. The entire menu of every dish was something that would otherwise be thrown away. And so a lot of people have written about it and talked about this travesty that one-third of all the food that's produced in the world is thrown away. One-third. And it's a very sobering statistic, as we know there's a third of the population of the world is either malnourished or on the verge of starvation. And so we think one-third is produced is something that we all feel both guilty about and want to something about. I was interested in the issue, actually it's not being talked about enough in this context, which is not the throwaway food, not the fruit and vegetables that are bruised or damaged, or the dairy that's expired in the counter at your supermarket, all of which are problems. But I'm more interested in, I think, the bigger problem, which is our own food cultures, our own expectations for a plate of food, which in Western culture is about a 7-ounce piece of protein surrounded by a little bit of vegetable. Now, that is the most wasteful diet in the history of the world. But we don't talk about that. We talk about the ugly fruits and vegetables and the expired dairy and what you left on your plate and feel guilty about scraping it away into the garbage. And that is a drop in the bucket compared to our everyday food diets, especially in the U.S. and in the Europe. And increasingly, we're exporting these ideas to the rest of the world. As we all know, the carrying capacity here can't afford that. So we need to change what is our expectations for a plate of food. And I like the idea that chefs have the ability to broadcast that kind of message. So wasted, the kebab of it, we had no protein set, we had meat everywhere. But they were as condiments and as flavorings out of respect to what the ecological conditions of the place demanded.
How would you go about changing the concept?
Well, let me tell you, I'll give you an example on the wasted menu. To change the concept, so here's two quick off the cuff, okay? One, there's 2 million hectares of wheat grown in the UK, 2 million hectares. 65% of the wheat is fed to animals. Now, no one says, that's the biggest example of waste in the Western world. Actually, it's not. In the United States, there's 120 million acres of corn, and we grow 99.999% of it goes into our gas tank and into cows. That's the height of inefficiency, but inefficiency is waste. And so then we demand a 7-ounce piece of protein on one side of our mouth or our plate, and the other, we talk about the wastefulness of our society. Well, how can you square that? You can't. So we didn't serve any of that. We took that wheat that was meant, by the way, why are we feeding wheat, the greatest crop in the history of the world next to rice and corn? Why are we feeding that to animals anyway? It has to do with subsidies in the UK, and really farmers are encouraged to grow the cheapest possible wheat for the greatest possible yield. And it's very low quality wheat, very low protein, kind of crappy. We used it as a forage to show, why are we feeding this to cows and horses? They said, what is that? And it was pretty delicious. We fermented it and we did a lot of things to it, but it still turned out quite delicious. But my point was to show, like, we cannot continue this way if we really want to tackle food waste and tackle democratizing and making food less expensive and feeding people more nutritiously. That's one example. Second example would be if the UK is a wheat culture, it is as much a dairy culture. Now, if you're a dairy culture and you have 50% of the births on your dairy farm are male, because they are, what do you do with a male cow? Well, in England, that male cow is shot within an hour of birth.
Mm-hmm.
In the head, boom, done. And thrown away, literally thrown away, composted. They are not even picked up and taken to a processing center for dog food. There's no market for even that. So what we served, actually, we convinced a dairy farm to raise 6 male bull calves. And we paid a lot of money because that male bull calf fed on the mother for almost 8-9 months and on grass. Very expensive to do. And we paid for the labor that went into it. It's extraordinarily expensive. The most expensive I ever paid for meat, let me just put it that way. But it was because we were forcing him to do something that he never did and didn't really want to do, and he wanted to make it sort of worth his while. But at the end of it, we had so much beautiful meat, veal. We made it into actually McNuggets. We made it, and we served it as a McNugget, like you would as a McDonald's in that tray. And basically what we said to the UK diner is, there is so much potential veal here surrounding you. You could open up a fast food chain, and instead of chicken McNuggets, you have free veal McNuggets, free. And the other point really is to say, if you want to have your clotted cream and your yogurt, you have to eat your veal. If you want to support the agriculture, and in this case, the dairy culture that is feeding your population, to do it in the right framework, to do it in the right balance, you absolutely cannot just eat the cream and the yogurt, you have to eat the veal. So to me, that's a nice example of wasted and a good reason to do the project that we did. Does that end up trickling down? I hope so. I hope that discussion continues, and it seems like it will in the UK, because nobody knew that 100% of their male dairy calves were shot at birth.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Neither did I.
I've been in England every year for the last 45 years. 100%.
Two questions. I'm sorry, off to you.
There is a few farms that are raising veal, but they're not part of dairy farms. They take them off of dairy farms, raising veal. Interestingly, I found maybe six farms that were raising the veal. Interestingly, 100% of those are exported.
Okay.
So I said, so very few people eat veal in England, but when they do, when it's on a menu, it's imported from France.
That's weird.
It's the weirdest thing I've ever heard in my life, but that's a food system that's out of whack.
Yeah.
We, as chefs, because we have this bully pub or whatever we have, I don't know what this is. We do have an opportunity to talk about these issues, either here in this forum or on our menus. That seems to me could change the food culture, but it has to start somewhere. And here it's starting up top.
You want to know why there's such a concentration on wheat in my native land. The answer is started in 1939 and it finished in 1945. So there was a political reason for it. I was rather interested in, where did you actually do the pop-up? Was it at a London restaurant that we know with the chef that we know?
No, it was the pop-up was at the rooftop of Selfridge's department in the middle of Oxford Street, because they wanted to pay for this. And I salute them. It was the last place in the world I thought I would be, in central London on the rooftop of...
I thought that was interesting.
But that got you the traffic.
You know what it did? Yeah. It wasn't the traffic. The traffic. But it also was the financial support, to be honest with you. But I'll tell you the reason I feel my conscience feels good about the work is because below us, the six floors that were below us, we're dealing with the most current fashions, the avant-garde. What is going to be the next trend? What is everyone going to be buying next year? That was happening in the store below us. And I thought, when I visited the first time 2 years ago, I thought, why couldn't a restaurant serve that same function? Why couldn't a restaurant, and because restaurants do, especially the chefs that are in this room and others that are going to be here tonight, why couldn't restaurants become places of avant-garde, of outlying ideas that are a little weird, a little wasted? This whole conversation is a little bit strange. But ultimately, like avant-garde art, bleed into the culture and introduce a new perspective. Where restaurants, you know, we think of restaurants as places of escape from our crazy world. But what about if we thought of restaurants as places of connection? Connection to the world around us, connection to ideas that are important but can be enjoyed and can be thought-provoking in a context of delight and pleasure. That is, to me, the future of great restaurants. And it's happening, again, in the chefs in this room.
Yeah, you do it. Massimo does it.
Yeah. How do you think events like this sort of help bring this conversation onto a global...
Well, of course, it
platform.
Sheds the light on this. So events like this, awards like this, allow me to have a kind of power. I say that it's the wrong word, but it's a platform.
Influence.
And I said before, the biggest result of being in the 50 best, I'm pretty new to the 50 best, I think it's my third year, is the cooks that come to me now. And I don't say that, I think I said it before, as it wasn't that big a deal, it was just more cooks. Actually, it's been the game changer for me, because I have two restaurants. The one in the city has always been okay with cooks, but the one at Stone Barn, we have 35 cooks, and it's very hard to get cooks to live just half an hour from the city. And when you have cooks from around the world, which I do now, I'd say three quarters of my staff is from elsewhere, not the United States, the drive, the energy, the passion that they bring to the cooking, it's changed my restaurant dramatically.
Do you also find that there's a lot of knowledge sharing going on between you guys, here, or is it all a bit fun?
I am stealing a lot of ideas, I know that.
You didn't mention insects.
I am not as interested in insects, because the history of my environment, my ecology, doesn't speak to insects. And I'm more interested in the idea that we have the possibility to eat higher on the food chain and improve our ecology and do it really deliciously. And nothing against insects, but
I'm
know
happy
from where...
You
no,
didn't
okay,
mention
good.
Them.
All right, good.
So why is this...
Sorry, last question. Yeah. So we're going to have to move pretty soon.
Okay. Why is this such a massive passion for you, this message that you're trying to get out? Is there like a personal backstory? Why do you care so much?
You know, it's a very self-involved passion because it's about looking for the ingredients that are as jaw-droppingly delicious as they could be. And that's where this all started. See, it started for everyone else in this room the same way. We're all greedy for these flavors because it makes us look like better chefs. Huh? I mean, that's the truth. And the thing that happened to me is that, first of all, Blue Hill is a farm. So I grew up working on a farm. And it's a dairy farm. It happens to be a dairy farm.
Do you make veal?
What? Yes, a lot of veal. And I've learned through the course of running the dairy farm that the only way a dairy farm is sustainable is by buying the veal, actually. It's the only way. If you're a small-scale dairy with 20 cows, as we are, that makes or breaks the profit is the veal. So 100% of the veal from my farm is run through my restaurants. And that's why I no longer have a menu in my restaurants, because I make everyone eat the veal. I cannot afford to not buy the veal because the farm... So now all of a sudden, but if you think about it that way and you extrapolate that into a larger implications for the farming community around you, that's where we need to go. You need to eat the veal if you're going to have the yogurt or the milk or whatever it is. And so... So my why it feels so passionate for me, again, I'm a little bit invested in it from the agriculture side, but also I'm just dogged, as any chef in this room or any chef that will be there tonight is dogged for flavors. And I have the opportunity to be on both my own farm and this Rockefeller-inspired farm that allows me to pursue a recipe for a dish from the ground up. That's a great honor and opportunity that every chef wants. I just happened, some kind of casino in the sky happened where I landed on this, and so I'm pursuing it. And part of my job is to talk about it, because otherwise being on a farm like I'm on without talking about it would be quite a shame. And so it's a passion to me, but it's a passion to everyone in here, again, and outside of here. And I think I just tend to talk a little bit more than others. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next guest, Virgilio Martinez from Lima, Peru, has made a rapid ascent through the numbers of the World's 50 Best. But this year in Melbourne won the award that I think all the chefs value the most, which is the Chef's Choice. So the only people who vote in this category are other fellow chefs. And Virgilio carried off that one. And when you hear what he has to say about Central and the other things that he's doing, I think you'll understand why his work is so appreciated. So here he is.
I want to say something. Before we listen to Virgilio, I wanted to make a call out to Pia, who is his wife, who is also a chef and co-owner, because although she's not part of this Chef's Choice Award, she is part of the accomplishments of their restaurant chain.
Is it time where she's... She's gonna be away from me for a while.
Oh dear.
In a good way. She's gonna be cooking there in a new restaurant. So we're gonna have Central, this place, and you know our organization for registering ingredients, Mater Iniciativa, is gonna be big in Lima. So we're gonna have a like Mater Lima, and then we're gonna have this lab in Cusco.
Oh.
Yeah, in the mountains at 4,000 meters above sea level. Yeah, and we're going to have this place.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
So you're making any more babies.
No more babies, yeah. Yeah. Last baby was, it's been tough. Yeah, no sleeping at all.
So, and how bad are the mudslides?
the mudslides. How bad?
What do you mean?
In Lima and Peru, the mudslides, the rain and flooding and mudslides.
Oh yeah, it was really bad.
Bad.
Really, really, really sad. I mean, we are really concerned about what's happening because it's not stopping. People think that it's stopped, but I think we're not ready for that. I mean, we're not expecting that. It took us by surprise.
But, you know, you've had it for so long. I mean, you've had that problem for so long.
Yeah, but people sometimes forget, and you know, the government tries to forget and hide, but now you cannot hide stuff. Things are happening, and people, you know, communicate this. So, yeah, we've been, all the chefs, we've been sending, well, of course, like, all our waters and stuff, like many things, because people were, you know, struggling.
You started mentioning about your project. Why don't you tell everybody in case they don't know about it?
Yeah. So we have Mater Iniciativa, which is our project that we started maybe 5 years ago, mm-hmm. to register ingredients, proving ingredients in different altitudes. So twice a week, we have a team, and we gather like mainly anthropologists and designers and you know, artists and whoever wants to come and they get inspiration and also cooks. We are 9 people working on it, and we register ingredients that we find in a very wide areas. We also register like things that are happening in you know, traditions and stuff like that. So because we have to go to, we live in a very diverse country. Like our biodiversity is huge, so we need to get this information because there are many ingredients that we don't know. And we didn't know. I mean, like 20 years ago, we were just talking about ceviches and you know and but not ceviches like hamburgers. You know, like, like very popular, yeah, everywhere. So I think now we have to take advantage of course, of our ingredients and work with our communities, with our people. So indigenous people is living in the Amazon, in the jungle, and you know how many species we have of fish in the jungle, species that we've never seen before, and potatoes, more than 4,700 varieties already registered. Yeah, but we don't see them. You go to the market and you only see 20. So we go and now we register from our side for 400. That's a lot. Yeah, so we're working with them. Like, and we have to understand seasonalities, how they change and stuff like that. Indian grains, corns, varieties, different plants. So we're working on that. And the main idea is just not for Central. No, sir. Just not for Central, just to share this with the whole community of people, the chefs, and not only chefs, the whole community of people related to food in Peru, because it's actually very good to see how communities of people in the Andes or in the Amazon are just growing their stuff, and they are very, very, you know, happy to see how their food is now, you know, in flying to restaurants or even flying to some other countries.
So terroir has been such a big part of the conversation, I think, in recent years. We were just talking about it with Yannick Leno as well, and you know, chefs like yourself, and Rennie, and kind of bringing indigenous projects into the forefront. What do you think's changed in the last couple of years? What made this such a, I don't want to call it a trend, but...
Nah, maybe if it's a trend, it's a very good trend. And but it's actually something real, because there's an obligation now. Like we just cannot afford to ship ingredients to call suppliers to think that you are a good chef because you work 15 hours in your kitchen and you are very creative because you are doing amazing dishes. Let's be honest. Like now, cooks. Now we're experiencing that our products, they have to be in our restaurants, and this is good because what is happening is that nobody is repeating. Everybody just wants to represent in some way, like translate what is happening in their territory. Yeah, so it's amazing because now you go to see Jenny Galeno's food or Rene or Central, whatever, and everybody has its own story. Everybody is, you know, using their people, territory, their stories to give you an experience. So I think it's good for everybody, and it's amazing for our producers. And Peru, in Peru, it's very obvious. I mean, like, I just go like 20 minutes from Lima, and I see all these people living in the mountains, in the Andes, and of course, it makes sense to use their ingredients. And of course, we've been inspired by the people who many, many years ago were doing that. I think if it's a trend or whatever, that's the way I think we'll be working in the future. And it's good to understand that we have to use our local ingredients. You know, this word of local is so much cliche now that, you know, sometimes I'm like ashamed, you know, like, I feel like weird to talk about local cuisine, but because what I do in Peru, what we do, is not local, because we're getting ingredients from the jungle, we're shipping ingredients from the Andes, from the jungle, so our food is not local. It's like a very global. It's, you know, we have so much microclimates that it could be replicated in every part of the world, actually. Yeah, and the whole mysticism of Peru, we're getting from because it's not just about ingredients in Peru, because if we go to Peru and we go foraging, it's not sustainable anyway. So the foraging thing, it works in Peru in some way. If you just do like a 5% of what we consume is forage, but the other part has to be like a part of the our you know, Inca heritage, our Amazonian heritage. So now it's better to connect to people and see what they are producing and cook with that. Yeah. So that makes us travel a lot to different parts of Peru just to understand. So we just don't go to forage ingredients. We're foraging ideas and you know, the way the people think about life in Peru. I mean, like, the connection that people have to the, you know, I think I was talking to you about this, the Mother Earth, how people respect, you know, the soil as God, you know, and then how the Amazon people they have communication somehow with plants, and they use the plants for healing and stuff like that. So once we start to understand this, our food is changing a lot. So there's a strong meaning. So we are now working with our communities in terms of philosophy and knowledge, and many things are happening. So that's why we are working with again the cliche of multidisciplinary groups, which it has to happen this way anyway, because at the end we are cooks and we don't know the whole thing. I mean, I just can't understand sometimes why people is talking to plants. So I need somebody to, you know, to give me that information. I need to read. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm not proud anymore. I used to be very proud of being in the kitchen 15 hours, and I was like very happy to achieve very good techniques. Not anymore. I mean, like, I'm not saying that now that I have to be away, you know, in the mountains and don't show up in the kitchen. No, it's just a balance nowadays. So, it's quite a pretty nice obligation, actually. It's just not me. I'm talking, there are many chefs doing this in Peru, in Latin America, too.
So how are you feeling about tonight? Do you think you're going to keep your position? Is there a lot of nervousness, excitement, or how does it feel?
Yeah, it's weird all the time. It's weird. So it's difficult to handle this pressure. You know, like journalists, like, it's normal. I mean, like, I'd be lying if I say like, oh yeah, I'm fine, I feel very relaxed. No. It's like, yeah, you wake up and you're like, where am I?
We still remember the roars of approval, though, when we were in Lima for the 50 Best Latin America for the first time, and they were at the top of that particular heap. We remember it well. One thing you have done that must have been a challenge, and it's a challenge that will face you as you think about going to other parts of the world, but you opened not just one but two restaurants in one of my native cities, and clearly you can't get the same kinds of things you can get in the mountains of Peru. And if you came to Australia, you would have the same dilemma.
Yeah.
What do you do about that?
When we had this opportunity to open in London, people wanted to open Central. So we honestly said it's impossible. I mean, like, we cannot bring the Amazon and the Andes, right. And it will be like so contradictory to our respect to. I mean, like, I speak to people that had this respect to nature, and I cannot just ship, you know, fly ingredients. So I thought like, why not just do whatever I eat in Lima in a casual way. Like when I have a day off, I go with my wife and we eat ceviches, causas, anticuchos, street food, whatever. So let's bring that in a very, let's say, London way, and make it affordable. And of course, we were not able to bring all these ingredients. So maybe kind of 5% of the ingredients, the ones who are really Peruvian and the ones that you really need, like the ají amarillo, rocoto, a few potatoes, stuff like that, quinoa, those ingredients, coffee, chocolate, cacao. We were bringing these ingredients, but the rest is like the octopus coming from Portugal. We work the same way that people work in London. So that makes things easier, and I don't get frustrated. I don't get any frustration of not doing what I want to do. And it's good in some way because I hate this word again of the we kind of do an embassy of Peruvian, but we actually do something like people go and people enjoy our culture and people see like, oh, this is Peruvian food, so people get to understand what ceviche, what is this restaurant, why we are working like this. So I would love to, you know what, I dream about do one night of Central in the mountains of the Himalayas, I don't know, like in the mountains of Russia, and do this concept of altitudes, and that would be amazing. And only one night, yeah?
Yeah.
It's not sustainable anyway.
You said something about the food that you like to eat when it's your day off. What do you eat?
What
foods that you like to eat?
Lots of seafood and vegetables in a with tiger's milk. You know ceviche, yes. And the sauce? Yeah, I love the tiger's milk. Like, I can have this as a breakfast. Like. You know, it's a liquefied like fish stock and ginger and garlic and coriander and some ají, some chili peppers from Peru, and lime juice. So we have this strong Japanese influence, which for me is amazing. So I love just fresh foods, fresh fish, fresh vegetables from our coast, and that's it. With tiger's milk instead of olive oil, that's nice.
Did you have room for one more question?
You're well known for discovering new ingredients. You described how you're continuing to do that with your lab at 4,000 meters and so on. What's the most exciting ingredient you've found in the last 2 years?
Now we're working on plants that die, you know. Now when you go to the, you see the Andes and you see how people, the textiles of the people, all these colors that they are getting, nowadays, people's taking advantage and there's synthetic, you know, chemicals. But when we go to the communities up in the mountains, we see that they are using these plants to give color, like red, yellow, even blues and stuff like that. So we are working with all these seeds, plants that we are getting all these colors. So now we're using this to cook, and they give flavor, they give a sense of place, they give, of course, a color to do an interpretation of the landscape, because of course we want to see, when you see a dish, that this dish is coming from somewhere that has this color, so we kind of also paint with these colors. And, and at one point, you see like guys like look like painters, but they're not.
Thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you.
And to conclude today's program, a chef from Paris, France, who re-entered the top 50 in the 30s, really great recognition for the work that he's doing, because he's reinventing the process of how you prepare stocks to go into his various recipes. Yannick Aleno is the chef at Pavillon Le Doyen in Paris. Here he is.
This is Yannick Alen, from Aleno Paris, au Pavillon Le Doyen, Paris, France.
Is something very important in the in the food. Everything is sauce, in fact. The sauce is a sauce. You can imagine that an ice cream also is a sauce you put in a sorbetière. Mm-hmm. A sauce is also a simple ganache you put in a chocolate. Mm-hmm. So if you work on the fundament of the cuisine, on sauces, especially in French sauces, you are working for a new generation of food. This is the fundament, okay? This is the foundation of our cuisine. Mm-hmm. For everything, everything is sauce. So, to understand, it's very easy to understand. Before, it was a sauce like that. So, we put ingredients in a pan, we boiled the things for many hours, and when the stock gets the taste, we did filtration, and you put that again on a heater to make the reduction, okay?
Ah, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, this is before. Mm-hmm. Now, why you cook a celeriac as a carrot? Mm-hmm. Or a piece of meat? Yeah. Or a piece of... No. Yeah. So every single element has its own temperature and its own time. Mm-hmm. For example, celeriac,
yes.
You have to cook it for 83 degrees mm-hmm. for 12 hours.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So then, when you get the perfect taste, because this is a perfect cook, mm-hmm. if you go... After that, you kill the celeriac. The taste of, because the squash turned in sugar, there is a lot of transformation inside by the heater. It's very aggressive. Put your hand on a heater for 12 hours, you will see how the things come. It will be burning. So I cook every single element one by one. After that, for sure, you have to take off water. To take off water, I'm not using the heater, but the chill way. Frozen.
Ah, frozen.
Frozen
okay.
way. Uh-huh. Why? Because when you are near under 6, the water crystallizes. And the water to crystallize need to push out all the things that they don't need to crystallize. That's what I'm looking for. This rare matter. So we do the reduction by the frozen way. The main difference is here. Perfect cooked. And you never pass through the best, the right temperature. You do reduction at that. And after that, this is before, and now you have that little taste like that. And you said, okay, I want to do my sauce. So you have to use meat. So I put meat. Then I put celeriac. Then I put truffle. Then I do my composition after cook. This is where the difference comes from. And is lighter. I get the minerality from the process, like a Grand Meursault, a Grand White Wine. So the minerality bring you the salinity. So I don't put salt anymore in my sauces. So it's very good for your body.
Wow.
It's crazy. Trust me, it's amazing. It's really amazing.
And you just discovered this.
Yeah, I work on it since the relative video also, 5 years now.
5 years. So
but it was a long process. And then if you understand that source is everything, you work in that direction. And also it's very important to me to work on that, because to do the perfect pairing with our fantastic wines, it's also fantastic. So now I can do new sorbet, I can do new ganaches, I can do new things I put in my pastries, mm-hmm. I can do new sauces, so everything is sauce. It's an evolution. And I think the world waits for us to have a reaction and an evolution. So I do believe that I have to work on the Renaissance cuisine française. It's very important. It means we have to think the things differently, because the world is changing. It's a new world today. So the French food don't have to be like been. So that's why I think the success came. And to answer your question.
Mm. Anyone else?
That is.
Do you mind a question?
Yeah, I've already asked you many questions as well. But I'm really curious, how competitive does it get when it comes around to award season and, when it comes to ratings and things like that? Does it get kind of between the...
I don't get
it. Does it get competitive around award season, you and other chefs?
A competition between us.
Yeah, do you get to feel more competitive around this time of year with all these awards?
I don't think it's a competition. I think it's just, now the perspective is from the world. It's not a unique French perspective. So the world is really open, and it's very interesting now to see what's happened around. Globally, the minister spoke about terroir. The world 50 best, I think, is now something very important for the food, because everyone know that they have to make the culture from their own countries. It's the opposite of the globalization, I think. And that competition is good, because everyone knows now he has to work on the terroir and his own terroir. And for us, it's fantastic. Look, today, remember that. When I was younger, I go in New York and I can buy something, I can get it in France. It was very exciting. And now you can have the same bag in New York or everywhere. It's not the case in food now, because you can travel, have different food, different taste, a new culture, a new approach, and a new understanding of the world. That is fantastic for us. That is fantastic for you also, and the customers, because they can really feel the difference now in France or here in Australia. That is fantastic.
I have a complicated question. I've noticed that for a while French cooking fell out of favor, even after the Nouvelle, it fell. But now there's a great revival of French cuisine all over the world, especially in the capitals. It's arriving at a time, however, where you just talked about terroir, and the French have always relied on terroir, but climate change is affecting terroir. And is it affecting, how is it affecting? How much is it affecting? Because it is changing. You know it in your wine industry and in your champagne.
Of course, the evolution is very intense. And because we took chefs also are completely involved on that. And we can look, I start to work on the terroir parisien in 2006. Who knows about terroir parisien? Who knows that some vegetables come from Paris? Original one. We forgot it 10 years ago also. And the action I did for that is now a trend in Paris. You know, people want to have their own veg, want to get the closer things you can get. So it's the creativity to change the things is very important. And it's in my blood, in my mind, to do that. It's a reflex. You know, if I work on sources, it's the same démarche.
the same process I did for the Terroir Parisien in 2006. So it's very interesting, and that approach we try to preserve our world, I think, because politics now knows that they have to take care of that. I spoke with the mayor of Paris, and she told me, "I want to do garden everywhere." So that's cool. We need all of us, consumers, chefs, press, to push them to do it, because it's our life, and the climate is something very important, right?
But do you think climate change is having an effect?
Yes, there is an effect.
How negative?
You're getting
it's more effect. Violent. Yeah. It's more violent now. You see the temperature. I am winemaker.
Yeah.
You know, and I, when I get an orage on my vineyard, it's a storm on the grapes. It's terrific, and the storms are more violent than before. So the regulation is.
And your temperature
yeah.
is very much
lower. You see it. So, of course, there is an impact. The veg are very stressed. We are more stressed than before.
Yeah.
I am a real French chef, you know, with my culture, with my knowledge, with my my past. So, but that knowledge bring me to make the French food differently, because I really want to make French food, and French food is based on what we know, the complexity of dishes, you know. And when you look on the past, if you have in the 19th century, you had the opportunity to get a chicken with an oyster, and it was very creative, right? And the unique thing to make it happen is sauces. The less the plate are with sauce, the more simple they are. Means you go straight to the point for the product. But it's very tough to mix different products without sauces. It not happen. This is the verb of the cuisine. So the less you have sauces in place, the less the food is simple. I don't say that it's bad or not, you know. But the complexity is French. Why? Because when you get a fantastic Corton from Bourgogne, fantastic vintage, and you test the wine, the complexity is there. Or a fantastic Bordeaux, or Côte du Rhône, an Hermitage, for example. So, if you try to get that wine with food, you have to make very complex food. In fact, that's why the French was so, comment ça, c'est pas con. It was very typical French, you know. And comment je peux dire ça? La complexité, la grande cuisine. La cuisine, c'est finalement la. La traduction du parfait dîner. You know what I mean? So, when you have a fantastic chicken, you cook it in whole. You don't put in cabbage. Also, you heat the entire food, and you try to mix things with that. And
I have a different question altogether, and one that's deep in my wife's heart, because I remember that we had lunch at Le Doyen about 35 years ago, and I think the chef owner at that time was a woman.
Yeah, right.
And there are not so many women in the ranks of top chefs in France, or top chefs around the world for that matter. Do you have any comment on why that is, and what needs to change for there to be more equal representation of the sexes?
If I can answer it, but with no infants and no things, the you know, there is a main difference between a man and a woman. We can't have babies. So since the
there's no such thing as never.
No, it's gonna never happen. Never happen. Which, you know what I mean? So I think that it is not because women are not talented. It is because that job is something very hard. And to combine your mom life and to combine chef life is very tough also. So I did the Bocuse d'Or in 99 with Sylvie. She's a fantastic chef, but she stopped to work because she had three babies. And in a couple, generally the men work and the women preserve the family life. And I think it's one of the issues for that. It's not because women, they are fantastic cooks for sure, but simple is life. It's like that, and I think I love women. You know, I think this is the base of everything, of that world. Anyway. So.
And one last question,
please,
we've been asked.
Oh, just wait.
Hmm?
Somebody might have a question.
Who?
I don't know.
Yeah, we can do it. Yeah.
Maybe, yeah, we'll do the photo
lab. Let me double check, because you say the complexity is the identity of the French cuisine.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right.
And your cuisine will be the future classic. Your sauce, the light sauce with the frozen technique, going to be the classic in the future?
Yeah.
Few decades.
I think so.
Okay.
I think so. We wrote a book on the sauces. Mm-hmm. It's called Sauces, Reflection of a Chef. We sold 25,000 copies mm-hmm. in France.
And
it's sold out, and we reprint because young chefs want to get that in their luggage.
Mm-hmm.
So of course it will become a classic. I went in Italy in restaurant, and I saw extraction of.
Mm-hmm.
So now I think it will be something classic here. Sure.
Okay. So how many percentage of the restaurant in France is using this technique, this idea?
It's the beginning.
Beginning.
So, okay. I train my chefs. You know, I train 50 chefs. There is a rank of my 50 after my second 3 stars I get in France. A journalist made a kind of... review about what the chefs I train. There is 50 guys, and those 50 now knows how to make my sauces, new sauces. So it's very interesting, very interesting. But I hope we have the opportunity to give you that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, madam.
Merci.
We'll be back with more from Australia next week. And in the meantime, what do we say?
Bye-bye.